interrupt this podcast to bring you a special announcement from our sponsor, the Microsoft Micro ISV Evangelism Team. Hello, this is Michael Lehman. I just wanted to let you know that the Project GlidePath Windows Vista Spotlight is now open for business on the projectglidepath.net website. If you're a Micro ISV and you have an application that installs, runs, and uninstalls cleanly on Windows Vista, be sure to register your application at projectglidepath.net. And if your application is one of the first 30 that's registered and passes our test, we'll send you a free Zune. We now return to our regularly scheduled podcast.
Welcome to the Micro ISV Show. On today's show, we have Jim Holmes and James Avery, authors of the O'Reilly book, Windows Developer Power Tools. As always, my co-host Bob Walsh is here. So, Bob,
okay.
Take it away.
James, Jim, this is just an amazing book. I got this a few days ago via Amazon. I was happy to buy it because I have never seen anything like this before. This is every possible imaginable free and open source tool that a Windows developer today might want to use or should be using. I was first struck by the fact that you had no less than 65 collaborators on this book in its 1,200 pages. What on earth overcame you to write such a huge, great book?
We might have gotten a little carried away. I think the proposal was for 800 pages. We just kept finding cool tools and showed an amazing lack of self-restraint. So we'd be writing away, we'd stumble across something else and think, oh man, we got to throw this in. But wait, we're already at 900 pages. Doesn't matter. Just keep going.
Well, you sure did. It's amazing as you look at this table of contents. This is the sort of thing that I'm glad you published it in December, because this is my next year's Christmas list of all the things I want to be able to be working with. But you look at the table of contents here, and you've got everything from tools out there for ASP.NET and the new .NET 3.0, all the way through things like creating documentation, writing code, testing your software, working with source control systems, building your applications on frameworks, troubleshooting, debugging, using decompilers and obfuscators, tightening up your code, exploring object relational mapping, enhancing web development, boosting productivity with Windows utilities, and on and on and on. I guess the first question I should ask you is, were you surprised at just the number of free and open source tools that were out there for Windows development?
You know, I don't think we were really surprised, just because so much of what, I mean, me and Jim are both kind of tool heads, and that we're always collecting these things and we see them somewhere and we bookmark them. And I think both of us have had just, you know, huge bookmark lists of stuff we want to check out or stuff we use. So, you know, I don't think, you know, there were actually showed, Jim was joking, we didn't show any restraint, but there actually are some tools that we left out, just because it was getting way too big. And the publisher actually told us at one point they were worried about whether they could actually bind it or whether it had to be, you know, split into multiple books, which we didn't want to do, just because we wanted the encyclopedia.
Well,
we wanted all
the encyclopedia here. I want the concession on the wrist braces, because you can't lift this 4-pound book and hold it in one hand. You have to prop it up there and not try and move that weight around as you're trying to go through all the sections of this book. Basically, what Jim and James have done, they've covered the entire waterfront of all the types of tools you need in the design and development and coding lifecycle of a Windows application developer, a Windows ASP developer. And basically, each of these entries that you have in here, I love the first section of each chapter where you basically provide some context for why people should be using these types of tools in the first place. Did each of you write a section of that, or did you kind of go back and forth on that?
For the intro sections, we definitely, one of us would normally take a first pass, and then the next one would come and kind of revise it and add stuff, and kind of just from both of our experience. And because a big part of it was, you know, it's important to show people what, you know, what tools are out there. But the really hard part is, okay, you know, when do you use these tools? How do you use these tools? That's the kind of knowledge that's really hard to get from, you know, a lot of times from a homepage of a tool. They'll tell you what they do, but they won't necessarily tell you when it's a good time to use that tool.
And the way you've got each of these tools laid out is you start with, for instance, Microsoft ASP at a glance. Then you get have a gain started section. This is, for instance, I think this is the very first tool here, which is for creating Ajax-enabled web applications. And after a bit of intro and the information like where will you find this tool, then you get into how you use this tool and work through just a couple of examples of that. And good screenshots make it very clear about what you're doing there. Obviously, you're not going to cover every little nook and cranny of each and every tool, because then you would have created the 26-volume Encyclopedia Britannica. But it gives lots of good examples. It also talks about gaining support for that particular tool, which is also a really important part of the process. And one of the things I kind of wondered, I guess, from a micro ISV point of view, is of these 170 tools, what would you say are the five most must-have tools for a micro ISV? And again, a micro ISV is basically a 1 to 5 or 10 tops person, self-funded software startup company that's out there trying to bring something to market. What are the five that you think are the ones that you just absolutely must have?
James, well, you want to give your list?
Sure. So when I started thinking of that, I immediately the first thing I thought of was Subversion. And Subversion is just, you know, a great open source source control system that we actually use to write the book. So a lot of times you have multiple authors, you have a tough time of emailing, you know, chapters back and forth, and oh, you made some ton of changes to this Word doc, but I've got this Word doc. So we actually had a Subversion repository we could both check into, you know, check in and out of, and kind of keep on track. And I think for, you know, there's when you, as soon as you get into some, you know, real development and stuff like that, you really need kind of a sophisticated source control system. And so the top of my list would be Subversion.
What would be number two?
Number two for me is actually a tool called Track. This is actually, interestingly enough, it's a Python-based application that you can install on your web server, and it gives you kind of all these application lifecycle tools built right in. So it has a wiki, it has a bug tracking system, and it actually gives you web access to your Subversion repository. So, you know, what I kind of look at, you know, I work on some side projects and stuff like that for fun, and, you know, hopefully eventually profit. The big thing is, how can I get, you know, what, you know, a big company has all these things by paying thousands and thousands of dollars for licenses. And, you know, in this way, there's two tools that basically give me, you know, that full lifecycle support of source control, wiki, bug tracker, you know, all that stuff for free, which I think is pretty compelling for a micro ISV.
Large budgets. Okay, well,
Number three, I have down MB Unit. So MB Unit is my new nickname for it, is unit testing for people who love unit testing, because it really goes that next level above NUnit and the unit testing that's built into Team System. And it really just gives you all these different ways you can test your code, doing like row testing where you pass the data in, automatically rolling back database transactions. It's just kind of that next level of testing. And when I look at, you know, micro ISVs, you've really got to get, you know, the most for your time and money. And I think the best way to do that is to be just religious about unit testing.
Well, you know, one of the things I really liked about each of these sections is that there are tools in there that I'd never heard of. And I could spend hours or days poking around to try and find it. For instance, NUnit Forms, which gives you NUnit basically for your win forms. I think that's really cool.
Correct.
How about number four?
Number four, I have cruisecontrol.net. which is kind of another piece of the application lifecycle and just giving you that continuous integration. So, you know, checking out of your Subversion, building your code, running all your unit tests. And really, it's just one of those other things where I look at it like when I look at a project, that's one of the most important things is getting continuous integration. And I think cruisecontrol.net is the best one out there for .NET environments.
Number five?
And number five, I kind of had a two-way tie, but I went with nHibernate. Okay. Just because this is nHibernate's an open source ORM tool. And I just look at it as a way, when you're a micro ISV and you're trying to get the most out of your time, you know, do you really need to be writing data access code?
As much code as we can possibly handle. Exactly. Okay, how about your co-authors list?
James and I think an awful lot alike. Subversion was a big one for me. I was the guy who wrote the article on Track and for the book. And when I wrote that article, so that would have been, what, James, 7 months ago or so?
Yep.
The install for Track was rather horrific. It was really, really painful to the point where it probably took me 2 or 3 days to get up and running. So I've chosen Bug Tracker, which is another great, very lightweight, very simple, no-maintenance bug tracking system. But then James and I were talking, and he said that since I'd written that article, Track has actually had a real sea change, and they've got a very simple install for it now on the Windows platform. So,
I ran that install in about, it took me about an hour just to get it all set up on my server, but that's pretty reasonable.
that's much better than the time that I spend. And Track really is pretty impressive. So being able to make use of that is a great thing. I'm also a huge fan of MBUnit. Since James had already hit cruise control for the continuous integration side of that, probably I would choose MS Build because that's really kind of the linchpin to be able to really wrap up a CI process. My fifth tool, I would use Watir, W-A-T-I-R, which is this really cool Ruby-based way to do web UI testing. So it's kind of a scripting engine that lets you instantiate a session of Internet Explorer and drive IE around through your website. And you've got full access to all the controls on the page. If you're really geeking out, you can get to things like view state, session variables, cookies, all that kind of stuff. It really lets you do some pretty powerful testing of your web UI. And by the way, if it's helpful, I shrinkstered links to all the homepages of these tools. Well, I wasn't smart enough to actually write them down, but I can read them off.
You know what?
Well,
let's do this.
Helpful.
We'll post those in the show notes, one way or another. We'll take a page out of Scott Hanselman's and the way that he does show notes and has those links in there. Speaking of Scott, by the way, I know he's done a podcast on Watir. I also see he's one of your two forwards, the other one being Mike Gunderoy. So to say that you guys are firing off with both barrels here is an understatement.
Well, we were definitely looking at this book. We thought, you know, who are the biggest names out there who kind of would resonate with who we're trying to get in touch with? And I mean, Hanselman and Mike are pretty much, I mean, with the Daily Grind and Hansel Minutes and stuff like that, they're definitely who we wanted to get writing for us.
Okay.
They're the tool gods. Well, and Scott was also, he gave us a great technical review, and he really pointed out a lot of things that really helped us polish off the book and get it in, you know, my obviously biased opinion, but in the great shape that it's in. So Scott gave us a lot of love all the way around.
In terms of just being able to write a book like this, you know, a lot of developers have in mind a desire to write a book at some point. How many months went into this project? You're laughing. That's a bad sign.
Oh, man.
It all kind of blurs together now. It was a long time. Well, how long was it, Jim? It was.
We started in February, and we finished and drop the book off to production in mid-November.
That's a long time.
Well, that sounds just about right.
So yeah. The question is, would you do it again?
It's still, don't ask me that yet. It's still too close.
The wounds haven't healed yet. I think about maybe 6 months, you might get the itch again.
Right. Haven't you noticed that about software and books, that you think it'll never, ever, ever get done, and it gets done with an absolutely last minute that you possibly can't stand it anymore, and then you forget, and then you do it again?
Well, that's like the book I'd written before this. When I was done, I said, you know, never again. Never again will I write a book. It's not worth it. And there was like a year later, I'm like, this would be a pretty cool book.
Did we finish the top five? I think we had a couple more to go. Okay.
No, actually, because I'd echoed things. So my list was Subversion, Track, MB Unit, MS Build, and Water.
Yeah.
And actually, hey, Bob, one interesting note on Water is that there's actually a new, for people who are kind of more comfortable in .NET instead of reaching out into Ruby, there's a new one called like WATIN. I'm not sure how you'd pronounce that, but it's kind of, they're trying to take the same approach, but using a .NET language, so using C# or something like that.
Let me ask you a couple other questions about just the whole sort of tool movement, let's call it that. Because you've climbed the mountain by writing this book way up high, and you kind of look down and see everything that's going on. And I guess I got a couple questions for you there. First one is, let's say that you are a micro ISV, and you want to create an open source tool. Do you think that you can do that as a micro ISV and make money with it? In other words, are any of the people that you've talked to as you've written this book, are they making money with these tools?
I think there's probably a pretty pretty good split between the people who are trying to make money and some people who are just putting it out there for free. There's, you know, one of the approaches you see a lot is people who offer it as open source, or they offer it as freeware for personal use or something like that. And they kind of sell another license for someone who doesn't want to, you know, who doesn't want the free version or something like that. I know like testdriven.net is that way, where it's a completely free download, but, you know, he's like, hey, this is completely free. But if you're using it inside a multi-million dollar corporation, you know, buy a $99 license. So I think some people like that are successful. And then one of the other real successful ways is like if you look at Community Server and .NET Nuke and some of these guys who kind of build consulting practices around what they put out there as open source.
Here's another question, looking out sort of out in the valley of all these tools. What are the ingredients for a successful tool project? I mean, what are the things you see that really pay off, and what were the things that some people are missing and their tools are just not as robustly picked up?
I think probably, you know, as with any product, you need to have a real clear vision, and you need to keep things very lean when you're starting off with that tool. You know, I think that the very good tools started off, you know, much in kind of the Unix mindset. Do one thing, do it really well, and grow out a little bit from there. If you try to do something that's broad and kind of unfocused, then you're just missing out on too many things. You're trying to do too many things at once, and you're going to end up doing nothing well. And so that's not going to bite for the community. The community is going to want to be able to, you know, hit your homepage, read something that's a pretty decent overview of the tool, grab it, get it working, and get that one thing done well. And if that's the case, they'll stick with you. And if it's not, then, you know, you blow it away and you move on. We had a couple tools that were somewhat like that we ran into for the book and kind of bounced past.
I think a good analogy is to write your tools like you write your methods. You know, make sure they do do one thing good. And as long as you're doing that, you're in good shape. You know, don't try to stuff too much in there. We've seen there's a couple like Visual Studio add-ins we looked at where, you know, they were just slowly building a menu of like cool features that they wanted, but it ends up being, you know, too large of an install, or some of the features don't work right, so you end up uninstalling the whole thing. You know, guys like testdriven.net, who focuses on, you know, running tests, or you look at like some of the other, I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head. Some of the other ones we mentioned, you know, cruise control, it doesn't try to be everything. It just tries to, you know, it's just doing continuous integration. I think focus is definitely a big part of writing a good tool.
And maybe kind of if you've got that good focus but allowing for extensibility, and where I'm going with that is thinking about Lutz Rotor's reflector. And, you know, many people in the .NET community are familiar with that. So Lutz built this great tool, but he was very focused on what it did, but he allowed some extensibility points there. And, you know, look at the great things that people have done with that. You've got reflector.graph for showing dependencies. You've got reflector.metrics for getting code metrics in there. So people do a lot of cool things by adding on to that tool that was well-designed, but with some extensibility in mind.
Here's another question for you. It looks like, I mean, for one thing, I got very excited when I saw this developing in .NET 3 chapter, because this is a whole new area. I, like a lot of developers, are just jumping into the pool and flailing around a bit, trying to get a sense of what's going on and what's going on out there. As you look at these tools, as you did this chapter, did you get the sense that there's going to be a whole lot of free and open source tools out there that will be useful to a .NET 3.0 developer?
I think, Jim, you could probably talk best to that since you focused most on that chapter.
You know, I think there's going to be some room for some growth there. You know, like you look at XAMLPad, there are a couple other XAML editors out there. It would seem to me that probably some folks are not going to be as happy with some of the features in the logging and the configuration widgets that they give out, which aren't bad. But, you know, one of the beauties of open source and freeware tools is you don't quite like how something works. It's not solving a problem that you need solved, so you go out and write your own. I would imagine that some things are going to grow up there because I think it's a cool environment. It'll get a lot of use, and people will start to build those
initiatives.
Bob, let me jump in here for a second. One of the things that that we do here at Channel 9 is try to foster a developer community. Now, you guys have included, you know, hundreds of tools from all these different developers. From the point of view of your 65 collaborators and everything else, what are you guys doing to try to create a community around the around your book, around your collaborators, around the tools? What kind of tools or sites or whatever have you guys tried to do to, you know, try to create a conversation around what you've done?
So one of the things we did was we started our own website around the book called windevpowertools.com. And basically the first feature that we've kind of we're doing very iterative. So the first feature we've put up there is basically the ability to browse through all the tools in the book and then to also build your own toolbox of what it is that, you know, you're currently using. So basically you can kind of go through and, you know, list out what your favorite tools are, what the tools you like to use. You can get a little image, throw it on your blog and say, hey, check out the tools that I like. You can also go through and kind of like dig. You can tell us that you love a tool. And the reason we use love is because a lot of times it really is some, you know, there's passion around people and their tools. And so you can go in there and you say, you know what, I love Subversion. And we're going to track how many people, you know, love a certain tool and be able to show, you know, here in the developer community, here are the tools that people are just really geeking out about right now. And that's really kind of the first step for the site. You know, over the next couple of months, we want to do stuff like add forums and make it so people can submit their own tools, submit articles about the tools, and just really kind of build out from there.
Well, that's pretty cool.
The site is also great because, you know, the nature of open source is that, you know, we started writing this book back in February last year, you know, 11 months ago. And, you know, already things are already stale in some of the articles, like Track, for instance. You know, they've greatly enhanced the install for it, and there are more features. It's tough to stay in touch with all of that, but our site will give everybody kind of a central place to go to get some new updates about what's going on with particular tools.
Well, that's pretty cool as well. So from the point of view of people who have tools that didn't end up in the book, are they also able to come to the site and say, hey, I've got a tool that I think people who read this book might be interested in?
Yep. Yeah. And right now it's actually just, there's an email that they can send me an email about it, but eventually we want to make it so that users can kind of submit those things themselves. And, you know, we'll probably put it through some sort of quick process to get it out there. But I mean, that's definitely one of the end goals, is that people will be able to just go add their own tools. It won't be us kind of being the gateway to that.
Awesome.
Okay.
All right, Bob, I know you've got some more questions. Why don't you carry on?
Let me ask you kind of a couple questions here. I don't think, from looking at this book, that you have a particular methodology axe to grind. Now, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe you do, but it seems to me that these are tools that, regardless of whether you, whatever methodology or mix of methodologies you use, you should know about these particular tools. Was there a particular, when we talk about things like test-driven development, it's easy to assume that really is coming from the agile world versus just sort of the other methodologies that are out there. Is it fair to say these tools are really not methodology specific?
Oh yeah, absolutely. James is very passionate about an agile approach. I am a very passionate guy about test driven, but you know, you can use test driven in other more traditional methodologies. But you know, you don't have to buy off on any particular methodology to be interested in finding out what particular frameworks might help you out, or what particular set of ASP controls you can make use of. The book is really focused around, I have a pain in my development cycle. You know, I've got a problem that I need to solve, and I might not even know exactly what that problem is. You can hit the table of contents and find out, okay, I'm having difficulties with regular expressions, so here are two tools, the regulator and regulazy, that can help me out. It's really not oriented toward any particular methodology.
You know, I'm kind of struck that if you were to load all 170 plus tools on one poor machine, that machine would just die of a heart attack. So I guess one question that comes to mind is, what would be some of the sort of the best practices for developers who need to manage all these tools? What should they be doing?
Well, one of the things I use is VMware or Virtual PC as a way to kind of try out different tools without muddying up your, you know, your base install. And actually, I've gotten in the habit of using Virtual PC or VMware for all of my development. I just do all my development in there, so it's really easy to, you know, roll back something that, you know, caused a problem or switch between different projects.
It's really kind of an interesting world we're heading toward, a virtualized world. Well, using VMs or VM in the generic sense to test out tools, that makes one thing that makes sense. How often should a developer be, you know, checking back to see if any of the 20 odd tools they're using has a new version? I mean, what's the new version rate, sort of generically speaking here?
It definitely varies from tool to tool. And one of our kind of jokes that we laugh about is Tortoise SVN, which is the Explorer extension for accessing Subversion repository. It seems like every time you log in that there's a new version. Because it's always popping up and saying, hey, there's a new version, do you want to go download it? And probably about half the time I actually go download it. But it definitely varies from project to project when there's a new release. One of the nice things is that I would say probably 50% of the projects now have an RSS feed that you can subscribe to. If you go to SourceForge, there's an RSS feed. I think there's one on CodePlex. You can subscribe and see when a new version comes out, you know, right in your RSS reader when you're reading blogs and stuff like that.
Yeah, so use RSS whenever possible to keep up to date on what tools are changing. How about when – oh, sure. Please.
Yeah, if I can add something else there too. You know, particularly from a micro ISV, you need to be very conscientious about the time you're spending on things, right? You need to have stable tools that are going to solve the problem for you. So kind of the flip side of that is, you know, yeah, it's great to keep abreast of all the changes. But on the other hand, if you pick your tools kind of carefully, then, you know, you might not really need to worry about keeping constantly updated unless you're running into particular problems.
Right. And I think it also varies a lot from tool to tool. So if you look at if you look at NUnit, you know, if there's a new version, you may be able to install that without having to change any of your code. You just kind of get some new features. But if you look at, you know, Enterprise Library or something like that, a new version might mean you're going to spend, you know, a couple weeks refactoring your application. And you just always got to, you know, weigh, you know, what the cost benefit on that. Is it going to be worth spending that time to get these new features?
Exactly. And then there are times when you actually want to sort of freeze the set of tools you've got, which gets us back to virtualization.
Right.
That tools that you use, for example, in Hibernate, if you used a version of that to create something, you may want to make sure that you have that version for version 3 of your product if you need to fix a bug or add a feature without going to, you know, the latest version, which may or may not be compatible with the library or the configuration files or so forth that you actually use to create it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, in the one of the things that I'm responsible for is the MicroISV Evangelist is this thing called Project GlidePath, and we're actually building that kind of capability into GlidePath to say, okay, I've downloaded a whole bunch of tools, and they're all related to my application, this particular version. Now I want to freeze that entire collection of tools and guidance and configuration files and everything so that if I've got to fix something for somebody, I've got the tools that match the files that they generated that match the code that runs.
Wow.
And so I think that, you know, it's virtualization, you know, in all these different ways, I think the tools are going to start thinking about that they have to, like, maintain some kind of context in addition to the whole virtualizing
well,
the entire
ask
machine.
Well, let me another question there, which is, okay, I go through this table of contents and I, you know, pick one from column A and one from B and C and D, and I'm up to probably Z here. What's any advice about how to go learn, you know, 20 different tools in a rational, logical approach to that? You know, anything you've learned having learned all these tools that you'd like to pass on?
You know, for me, the big thing is figure out what the pains are in your process, right? You know, you've got specific difficulties that you're trying to solve, and find something that's going to solve, you know, your biggest pain. Dive into that, solve that problem, and then just move on. If you, you know, so you find, you know, 25 cool tools that you want to check out, you can't focus on all those at the same time, and you're going to end up having a lot of thrash and churn while you're trying to press forward with your product, right? So you've got all these cool tools that are taken away from your time to deliver. So, you know, just do it in a very oriented, logical fashion. Solve one problem, learn that tool, move on to the next problem.
Well, you know,
would be my recommendation.
Go ahead, please.
When it comes to, you know, actually kind of learning and picking up a tool, I'm one of those guys that I find it, I look for the download link. I download it, I install it, I start playing with it. You know, if I can't figure it out, I go look for some documentation. So that's one of the things we kind of built into the website for fun too, is that we always try to provide a download link right to the download page. So if you read the description, you're like, I like it, click that, you can go right and grab the download right away.
I think that's a good approach.
Just because that's kind of my approach.
That I'm about to try myself, because this is partly triggered by your book and partly triggered by Vista, because I know there's 10,000 shortcuts in there and I don't know any of them, plus in new Office 12, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of those there, plus all the different things, little bitsoids of information and all these tools. So I reached back into my past and I asked myself, well, what got me this far? What worked for me, you know, back in the old days where dinosaurs roamed and I went to high school? And I finally found somebody who still sells blank flashcards. These are like 2x3 cards.
Oh my God.
And I'm thinking, I want to try this out, and I'll be blogging about it at todoorelse.com. But I think that one method might be just the old low-tech way of, you know, you write it down on a flashcard, you write down, you know, the answer, if you will, on the back. You keep running that by your eyes until it sinks in, put it aside, review it in a week, put it aside, review it in 3 weeks. It's in long-term memory, and while you won't pass your AP history test, you'll be able to master those tools. I mean, I look at Subversion and the command line structure there. I mean, I could spend a lot of time trying to swat that all up in one go. I'd rather take that one little bit at a time as I need to, and just sort of build my little flashcard library. So I'm going to be trying that on some of the tools that I see in here, and I'll let you know how that works out. One other thing that people probably ask about these tools is the support end of things. Generally speaking, is there, you know, really good, shall we say, acceptance of people who query a particular project and say, hey, I'm having this problem. I'm not contributing to the open source behind this. I'm a newbie. I've just started using it. Is there generally a pretty good acceptance of people like that? Do they get the answers they need?
I think it kind of varies across the board between different applications. Most of the active applications you come across are going to have, you know, good forums and, you know, good people that hang out in the forums. You know, much like, you know, if you go to ASP.NET, you can get, you know, just about any question answered about ASP.NET. There's a lot of places that have forums, lots like that. And Hibernate forums, I hang out there a lot. You know, and a lot of times, sure, it's the same question over and over again, but, you know, everybody's there kind of excited about the tool, so they're all kind of pitching in and helping out. And then I think there's, you know, I've never really seen, you know, kind of any sort of animosity or stuff like that, but there are some tools that aren't as well supported where you're going to have a harder time getting a response. There may not be any forums. You may have to send an email and hope you get an answer back. So I think it kind of varies from project to project.
Yeah, and that's a big impact on selecting tools, right? You know, if you're evaluating a tool to put in your hip pocket for your micro ISV, you need to consider that level of support. So, you know, troll those forums, troll those mailing lists, see if, you know, there's an active community there, because that's a big part of, you know, being able to properly implement that to really implement, okay.
One more question I can think of right now is, and it's not really a micro ISV question, though a lot of micro ISVs still have a day job somewhere out there in cubicle land. What would be the one tool you'd recommend that a salaried programmer learn and master just for being able to impress his bosses?
Oh, man. Okay. I'm a big fan of FXCop, because that helps you in so many different ways, right? You know, you point it at your assemblies, you fire it off, and it shows you various things that you may have forgotten about. It shows you some critical security issues that you might not have properly handled, and it helps you and your team really boost your quality. I think that's, if there's one, you know, there's 170 tools that I'd like to throw out, but that might be one kind of low hanging thing for me.
I'd have to go with cruise control, for a couple different reasons. One, because if you tell your boss that you set up a CI server, that just sounds cool. I mean, it sounds like a lot of work, right? And then also, you know, you have all these different reports and you have these little lights that pop up and flash, and you know, a lot of managers don't really know much about code, but they all understand red and green lights and what's good and what's bad.
Okay.
So it just looks like a good way to impress your boss.
As well as really help your development process.
Correct. That too, but, you know.
I've been looking forward to it. Somebody should put a link up where you can buy one of those at Amazon. Their affiliate money would look pretty good after reading this book. Michael, any questions to wrap up with?
I think you guys have just done a fabulous job of collecting all this stuff, you and your 65 collaborators. I can't even imagine the concept of 65 collaborators. And I really like the fact that you guys used some source code control to manage all of that. Do you guys have any advice for anyone who might be optimistic enough to believe that they are going to write their own book? If people want to stand on your shoulders instead of on your toes, what would you tell them?
I think the one thing I learned in the books I've written is that if you want to write a book, it's kind of the same as a lot of other things, is find what you are passionate about and go towards that. Because when you write it, it'll work a lot better. If it's something you love, then you'll be able to write about it, no problem. If you try to squeeze yourself into, you know, something a publisher is suggesting or something that you think would sell, it's really going to be a lot harder.
I'll give one.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, this was obviously something we were passionate about. If you want the more kind of less passionate, more business oriented side, you just
more practical, Jim. That's what
the more practical side of things. Write. Be aware of what you're getting into. Writing a book is a great thing. This was, I cannot believe that I wrote a almost 1300 page book as my first writing effort. Thank God James was there. Be aware of the amount of work that you're getting into and be very realistic, you know, set yourself a schedule. We had a very good schedule. We kind of approached things in actually an agile manner for writing this book. We hit the hard sections first. Had workflows for each of the collaborators that were contributing to us, and that was a pretty big help. Just being very sensible about how we approached it, and plus it was cool stuff, so it was fun. Even though it was a lot of work, it was a lot of fun.
Is it required to get somebody else as your same name to, as a co-author?
Well, I've got one piece of advice for everyone listening
bonus
to
point.
This podcast, and that is buy this book. It's going to just revolutionize you as a programmer to get the most modern, up-to-date, comprehensive list of things that you should be using and knowing how to use. And I'll even throw in one more part of that advice, which is go to windevpowertools.com and click on the buy the book link they have there, where they'll get that little affiliate love from Amazon, because I'll tell you, a book like this is definitely a labor of love more than it's a labor of revenue. And then every dollar that we help them get means just a bit more payback for something they've done that's going to help a lot of people in this community. Oh, sometimes. I didn't. What can
Bob,
I say?
You're such a fanboy.
I'm really impressed by this book, except for the fact I wish they'd printed it on lighter paper. It's just, you know, I could kill somebody by dropping this book on their head from 3 feet above them.
Well, definitely don't hold it above your head while you're reading, like in bed or something like that, because it could be.
You're not responsible for any injuries.
We're not,
right?
Not responsible
Jim,
for any injuries.
Thank you so much for writing this book, and thank you for being on the Micro ISV show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, very much. Thank you, Jim and James. And as always, this is Michael Lehman and Bob Walsh, co-host of the Micro ISV show here on Channel 9. And check back next week for the next episode of the Micro ISV show.